where we're going. We have had three bills set for work session, and we're going to take one of those to work session first off, because I think it will go very quickly. The other, that's House Bill 2125. House Bill 2303 and 2339 will, the amendments that were being prepared are not ready yet, and so those will be carried over yet again to tomorrow. We will proceed through the public hearings in the order in which the agenda is printed. That is House Bill 2765, then 2869, then 3336. So I will open a work session on House Bill 2125. Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2125 comes with request of Attorney General Hardy Morris for the Department of Justice. And this bill is a bill that we, similar to the bill that we have every year, that's an answer to changes to federal law. The federal government supplies a significant portion of the monies that we have for aid-dependent children. And this bill, if we don't pass it, will cause as much as a $68 million loss in federal revenue. What the bill does requires that child support obligations be reviewed every 3 years or sooner if the state regulations call for review sooner than every 3 years. And then most of the bill beyond that is in the Dash 2 amendments, changed the existing definition of health care plan to include not only providing health care coverage for children through a private employer group insurance, but also include coverage of health insurance to a public entity such as the state health insurance program. Defines providing party and substitutes the term for obligor, requires a cost to satisfy health care must be included in child support calculation. Adds the definition of medical support for the purpose of child support, the cost of premiums and other uncovered medical costs such as co-pays and out-of-pocket costs for urgent care, clarifies that support orders could be ordered against either the obligor or the obligee of a health care coverage, requires health care coverage be included in all support orders, requires a court of support enforcement division of the Department of Justice to make written findings on whether to order the payment of medical support, provides a court or support enforcement division, prohibits a court or support enforcement division from ordering a medically needy person to pay medical support or to order a person who has a child in a household who is eligible to receive medical assistance. It has an effective date of October 1, 2007. Ronell Schenkel and the Department of Justice are here to support enforcement division to answer any technical questions.
Thank you, counsel. Committee, in my three sessions serving on the Judiciary Committee, I think we've had a bill dealing with sort of alignment of our support enforcement process in the state with federal law each session, and we do it because federal law evolves and we need to make sure we are operating in tandem with them, if for no other reason because federal dollars ride on it. And the general thrust of this mainly deals with medical coverage for children who are covered by a support obligation. Any questions you'd like to put either to counsel or to Ms. Schenkel from the Department of Justice?
Just one.
Representative Krieger.
Is the date of October the effective date for the purpose of them being able to prepare for that, or are we waiting till October? That's usually the current fiscal year.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, I think Ronell Schenkel can address that. It may have something to do with federal implementation.
Good morning, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Ronell Schenkel with the Department of Justice. Chair McPherson and Representative Krieger, as I understand it, and I'm bringing Tom Hedberg, the expert for child support, up with me, that October date is to keep us in compliance with the federal regulations that tell us we need to have these no provisions in our state law and the timing of having those in our state law.
Chair McPherson, Representative Krieger. This is especially Thomas Hedberg. Manager with the Child Support Program for Policy and Legislation. This is especially pertaining to the $25 fee that is required by the federal government to be in place by that time.
Any further questions? Representative Cameron.
I just wanted to clarify on the $25 fee. Last time I had some notes here that who is actually paying that fee? Is it the individual who is obligated to the child support, or is it the individual who is receiving the child support?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, the federal government gave the program the choice of three, either the state to pay the fee or to charge it to the obligor, the obligated parent that will be paying the support amount, or to charge it to the obligee, the person receiving payment. There's a fiscal on the state paying it, obviously.
Right.
There's also a fiscal on the obligor paying it. By the way, the federal government has allotted it and labeled it a fee, which means we wouldn't be able to collect it until after all the child support was paid. So the state, in a sense, would have to pay it up front and then collect it later. So we have suggested to the legislature that we charge the obligee the $25 after the first $500 has been paid.
Mr. Chair, I have a problem with that was the whole philosophy on child support. I think a father or mother who is obligated to pay for the child support should be doing that. Now we got the state involved because they're not doing it properly, and now we're going to charge the person who is receiving the child support $25 because the individual who's obligated to pay it isn't doing their job responsibilities. So I just have a problem with it's a principal issue. It's only $25 after $500 has been received, but it's $25 out of somebody's child support that I think is a problem.
Any response or comments on that, Mr. Hedberg or Ms. Schenkel?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron. These would be cases where these are never TANF cases. These are families that have never received state assistance. And, yes, we do recognize it is not the greatest choice maybe that we charge the obligee, but we were trying to be in a situation where we did not create a fiscal responsibility on the state at this time. It gets complicated in the regulations that the federal government sat down on being able to charge the obligated parent. And I would tell you these aren't parents that are not paying. These are paying parents because they would have paid the first $500 and then continue to pay. But the limitations they place on the program is that the obligor would have to voluntarily pay the amount at the time it was owed. Or you would put it on the account and you would collect it at a later time. But the state would still be responsible in that fiscal year of paying that amount, of which two-thirds went back to the federal government.
And Chair McPherson, if I might add, and Representative Cameron, just one other small piece of information. The child support program is not a means-tested program. Anyone can obtain our services at any time. The father or the mother can apply. And so we actually have a very wide range of income economic family situations in our program. You hear the most about our lower-income folks in our TANF, but we do have quite a myriad of cases out of the 250,000 cases in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, I'm just voicing that concern. I will support the bill, but reserve the right to make that comment. And it's a principal issue here.
Very good.
Ms. Schenkel, do the Dash 2 amendments supersede the Dash 1?
Chair McPherson and Council Taylor, that is correct.
Mr.
Chair? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, Ms. Schenkel and Mr. Hedberg. There were some concerns raised at the public hearing on this by the Oregon Law Center regarding whether medical costs not covered by insurance should be shared, and also the additional award of medical support creating an ineligibility for the Oregon Health Plan. Have those concerns been addressed in the Dash 2 amendments?
Chair McPherson and Representative Bonamici, a part of the reason, beyond just the technical difficulties of this, that it has taken this long to bring these amendments before the committee is that we have been working very closely with the Oregon Law Center on these amendments, which are now consensus amendments, and we've gotten as far as we can on resolving their issues. There are a couple of concerns they still want to work with us on, but they're going to do that through the guidelines process.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hedberg, this is very complicated, and I'm sure we want to pass it so we get this program taken. But is there any way, do we get feedback to the federal government that some way we need to be assuring medical treatment, not just providing insurance? Is there any way is there a reporting process, or can we initiate a system where, you know, we're spending this money and time and effort for insurance, but are we getting, requiring preventive care?
Okay. Chair McPherson, Representative Lisnett. We don't directly feedback how the process is going as for whether the family actually receives the health care coverage. We will be judged on how well we order it to in each order and how well we provide that we enforce it. There is a national medical work group that is supposed to be evaluating how this is done. How this will be, how effective this process will be when all the rules and everything are finished and every state has implemented it.
But all right, Mr. Chair, but I mean, well, I appreciate what you're saying, but if you see the, you know, if we're spending this money, we have all this program, but the children are not seeing a doctor every year or every 6 months, we're wasting a lot of money and staff and all sorts of things to provide a program that provides insurance if it's not being used. Some way before we provide that insurance, we should say you've got to have this child in once a year for checkups and shots and primary care.
Chairman Pearson, I represent.
I know we're not going to change that today.
Well, we have made some slight changes, Representative Wisna and Chairman Pearson and members of the committee. We have been working on that issue for the past, this will be the third session, and there are several pieces to what you've just commented on. One is that we've, I think, strengthened over the years, you have helped us to make sure that we're not simply enforcing the right to have insurance, but we're actually having satisfactory health care coverage, which is defined in the statutes now to say it needs to be coverage that's actually going to cover the child. If mom and dad are in opposite corners of the state and that insurance is not going to provide the necessary medical coverage, then we're not going to order that because that's not helpful. What this bill allows us to do is a next step forward. The federal government has been saying we really want kids covered. That's the goal here rather than having to depend on Medicaid. So the next step is we can look to state insurance programs but factoring in those costs so that the families help pay for those in premiums and out-of-pocket, but we're looking at really having the child receiving health care coverage. Exactly what you're saying is what this is the next step towards.
Treatment, not care, insurance.
Correct.
Because all we're doing is counting the people who have the insurance, but not counting, you know, the preventive and primary care received. We're not, we don't have an effective program. No, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We're in work session. I have this passed a note indicating there's another witness who would like to testify, Cressida White, on this bill, although she indicates she's in support. So unless there's more information that we would, the committee feels they need to draw from other sources, I intend to go forward with our work session here. Mm-hmm. If there are no further questions or comments, do I hear a motion? It would be on the dash two amendments.
Recommend that we adopt the dash two amendments to 2125.
Representative Cameron moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 2125. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The dash two amendments are in the bill. Is there a motion on the main bill?
Mr. Chair, I recommend that we send House Bill 2125 as amended to the House floor. Do pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2125 as amended to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Excused.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye.
House Bill 2125 moves to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Now, committee, we did have some discussion here about some policy issues, so I would think it may, perhaps it ought to be carried on the floor, although it is rather technical and probably a must do kind of decision. Is there somebody who would like to carry this bill on the floor? Representative Comp, thank you very much. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2125 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2765. Council Plummer.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2765 compels the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to require at least 24 hours of training in mental illness recognition using a crisis intervention training model. It requires that the training include 12 hours classroom and 12 hours scenario training.
Thank you, Council. And we have Representative Lim, chief sponsor of the bill. And Representative Crummell, was this the bill that you were here on? Would the two of you like to come up together to present on this?
Thank you.
In whatever order you choose, representatives.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lim. I'll be fairly brief because I need to get down to a Ways and Means Committee meeting. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummel, House District 26, which is Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. Being placed in front of you is a letter of testimony from Terry Barton. She is a constituent of mine and lives in Wilsonville. After the high-profile James Chasey case last summer, she sent me an email in which she charged, and rightfully so, that we are all responsible because our police are not being trained in how to handle mental illness cases. And that all, and she was suggesting that all officers should have training. In response to that, I had drafted House Bill 3007, but I'm here today to speak in support of House Bill 2765, and if you'll indulge me, I'd like to read her some of her comments into the letter, into the record. Quote, my nephew, this is from Rosemary Terry Barton, in support of House Bill 2765. My nephew, James P. Chasey, Jr., was beaten to death by Portland police officers last September. He was mentally ill. Years ago, it was determined that mentally ill people should not be held in hospitals, but should be allowed to live in the community. James lived in an apartment not far from where he was killed. He chose to live in Northwest Portland because he had always loved the area where he could hear live music, walk to his church, and just hang out in an area that was interesting to him. He was of slight build, weighing about 140 pounds. He was a very gentle person who would not even kill a bug. He did not bathe often or shave, so some people may have judged him by how he looked. The day he was killed, two police officers saw him standing on a street corner. He was undoubtedly scruffy-looking, but he was not doing anything wrong. Later, the officers said they thought he might have urinated on the street, but they did not see him do that, nor did anyone else. They said they thought he might have been on drugs, but an autopsy found no drugs in his system. They reported that he was a homeless person, but he was not. It apparently did not occur to them that he might have been mentally ill. When they came at him, he ran. The officers and other witnesses said he had a look of terror on his face. Possibly he had been abused by police before and had reason to be terrified. Possibly his mental illness triggered the terror. We will never know why he ran, but the police chased him down, knocked him to the street, and beat him. Several other police officers became involved. Paramedics came and looked at him, but did not recognize his serious injuries. The goal of the police officers was to get him into jail for resisting arrest. He later died in the back of a police car. The officers involved have not been held accountable. How many other times have mentally ill people been mistreated by police in Oregon? Would this incident have been reported in the paper if James had not died? Will these officers recognize mental illness when they encounter it again? The amount of training required by this proposed law is minimal, but it's a start. It's certainly better than nothing. I don't see how anyone could oppose this requirement, and it should be passed without delay. End quote. In my own experience, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I have a lot of experience in dealing with injuries, particularly sports-related injuries, and I can tell you that the body can take a lot of beatings, if you will. But when people are oversized, and this is one of the reasons why in wrestling there are weight classes, is so that there's not an unfair advantage. But in sports such as football, which is a high collision sport, the body can really take quite a bit. But in the case of Mr. Chasey, it was reported after the autopsy that he had several fractured ribs and several other injuries. I think the officers, while in Mrs. Barton's letter she states that have not been held accountable, I'm sure that they are probably dealing with this on a daily basis. And I know that she and myself included have a lot of respect for our police officers. However, they do need to be trained, and especially as we are seeing more and more mental illness particularly in our urban areas, but all over the state. And lacking in mental health training probably led to the mishandling of this case from the very beginning. So, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I do hope that you will take this bill to work session today and that you will pass it onto the floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Cromwell. We'll hear from Representative Lim, and I see Senator Gordley has come to the room. Senator, would you like to come up and join the other representatives at the witness table?
Mr. Chair, if there's no questions for me, I'll go ahead and excuse myself if that's all right.
And Representative Cromwell, thank you for waiting patiently through our work session to present on this bill.
Okay. She asked me to do first. Okay. Chairman Pearson and the members of the committee, for the record, my name is John Lim, state representative from District 50. In your committee, you have 8 my bills. None of them passed out. Some of them have a public hearing. But this is one of the bills. I hope you have a public hearing, also have a work session, hopefully. I just want to give you some pressure, you know, on that point.
We feel the pressure, Representative. Okay.
Thank you. I'm reading from my testimony I have written. I came before you today to testify for House Bill 2765, which requires a state academy to establish a minimum of 24 hours of crisis intervention training, which is called CIT, in their curriculum for law enforcement cadets. This subject became dear to my heart as I followed the story of James Chessie last October. KATU News reported that Mr. Chessie died of a trauma to his chest as a police restrained him. It later came out that Mr. Chessie suffered from schizophrenia. I do not want to put blame on any law enforcement officers. I just want to prevent losing more lives, which is good for the mentally ill community and good for the public image. After research and talking with the State Academy, I introduced a House Bill, which is you have in your committee, 2765. Part of the curriculum must have 12 hours of classroom training and 12 hours of scenario training. I chose this figure because that's what is currently in place for State Academy. I knew that we could afford this in this biennium. CIT model have been successful since 1988. They originated in the Memphis Police Department when Memphis looked for a way to prepare their police with how to handle special responses where lives may not be in immediate danger, but somebody is acting erratically. In 1998, Memphis Police Department joined in partnership with Memphis Chapter of Alliance on Mental Illness. Mental health providers and the University of Memphis and the University of Tennessee. Since implementing this training, Tennessee, Texas, and Ohio, and plus many other states, have all benefited from this CIT model. According to the Memphis Training Department's website, the city of Memphis has experienced the immediate crisis response, a decrease in the use of force and arrest, and officers' injuries during crisis events have declined. In Akron, Ohio, more than 3,000 individuals have been processed by CIT officers since May 2000, with about 75% of cases being transported to mental health treatment and 6% arrested. I understand that the Academy is not in favor of this mandate, but I say we need to do this so that we do not risk having this taken from future curriculum. I'm sure I provided you the copy of the letter from the NAMI, Oregon, and I'm going to read just one phrase. Currently, CIT training is occurring here and there around the state. Having a mandate minimum of training hours would make the program consistent and provide assurance of an information safety net for those who have mental illness and for those who love someone who does. And also, I'm sure you have the copy from the representative Andy Olson, state representative, and he has been a law enforcement officer around 30 years, and I have provided that. To make additional comment, in nowadays, we have more mentally people increasing continually in the society, on the street. It is important to recognize the symptoms of those people who are mentally ill. With a proper training, at least minimum 24 hours, and it will give them additional tool to find out the symptoms of the mental ill. We don't have to resort to the forces for those people. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative. Senator Gordley.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I am Avell Gordley, representing Senate District 23 in Multnomah County. And first of all, I would like to thank my colleague, former Senator, now Representative Lim, for bringing this important public policy forward to your committee. Just recalling last session and some work that we accomplished through the Public Safety Subcommittee of Ways and Means, which I chaired, we were finally able to put in place funding that would allow the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to finally put in place a component focused on dealing with crisis intervention training. And the good Representative Wisnut, your vice chair, served with me on that committee, and I know that he recalls the many discussions that we had about the importance of having this component added to the training that will now be available to all recruits going through the academy. House Bill 2765 strengthens what we have put in place and allows us to advance what we have put in place. I want you to know that I've been in the place of being that parent who was on the other end of the line, talking with the police, with a loved one in crisis, and hoping and praying that the officers responding would be properly trained, have the right sensitivities, sensibilities, that they'd be culturally competent, all of that. I won't get into the rest of my own personal experience and story, but I do know that this is a very important piece of legislation. It's an additional tool in the toolbox of skills and resources that we want to make available to all of our peace officers, and not just police officers, corrections folks, and anyone else who works in public safety who would have the occasion to have contact with someone in a mental health crisis. So this is a very important piece of legislation. It is my hope that you will move it forward through a work session today. And again, I just can't say enough about the leadership of Senator Lim. I still call him Senator Senator Lim in bringing this this measure forward.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Representative for being here today. Just a quick question. In Representative Olson's written testimony, he refers to House Bill 3524, which is the voluntary means for family members and custodial treatment centers to provide information in the LED system so that it sounds like to me a police officer pulls somebody over. There's information in the LEDs that maybe there is a, he goes on to some other examples of Alzheimer's or somebody else has that mental issue. Have you looked at that bill and are we supportive of that bill as well? Would that be another tool that could help? Just curious if you're familiar with that.
Yeah, thank you, Chair McPherson and Representative Cameron. And this morning I just read it and given to me, and then the bill is good, bill is supported, and then I think that's the good bill. In conjunction with my bill 2765, it could work well.
And Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, I've not looked at the bill, but we'll do so when I return to my office.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I don't have a question. I just want to thank you, Senator Gordley, and Senator Representative Lim, and our own Representative Barker for bringing this bill forward. I did a day-long ride-along with the Washington County Sheriff not too long ago, and a significant amount of the time that we spent was dealing with people with mental illness. And I remember thinking, I sure hope these people have been trained. They did an excellent job dealing with the situation, but I remember thinking how important it would be for them to have training to be able to ascertain the situation that they were in properly. So thank you very much for bringing this bill forward.
If I may add one thing, Mr. Chairman, we have formed a mental health caucus this session that meets weekly every Thursday from 8 to 9 in room 343. The co-chairs include Representative Maurer and then also Bob Junedeff, who is Executive Director of the Oregon Advocacy Center. At an upcoming meeting, we will have a presentation from the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training outlining their current efforts around crisis intervention training. They call it something else, but it's focused on responding appropriately and with sensitivity to those who are in mental health crisis.
Good. Well, if there are no further questions, then thank you very much, Senator and Representative, for coming.
I appreciate it. And before I move out, I want you to know that we have 10 representative senators the co-sponsoring of this bill. I could get a lot more, but this is only the sample representative of the legislatures. Thank you very much.
Very good. Thank you. Next, we'll hear from Cameron Campbell from DPSST.
Good morning, Chair McPherson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Cameron Campbell. I'm the Director of Training for the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. I know the committee's time is valuable, and so I will try to keep my comments short. Contrary to perhaps popular belief, the department does not take a position on this particular bill, primarily because we're a little unclear about the intent of the bill in its relationship to what we currently provide for training. As you may know, the department recently adopted and moved to a 16-week basic police training curriculum that began in January of this year. Our first class will graduate the end of this month. That particular curriculum does include an increased amount of training in mental illness recognition and provides for a significant amount of scenario training as part of it. That curriculum was developed with the assistance of Officer Paul Ware with the Portland Police Bureau, who is one of the I guess, originators or founders of the crisis intervention team training for the Police Bureau back in 1995 when that started. And what we did, since the department's mission is to train officers statewide, we looked at the Memphis model, which has been cited quite a bit. And what makes the Memphis model so successful in its application is exactly the team concept. Crisis CIT actually refers to crisis intervention team, and then there is a trained component to that. But what makes the model in Memphis so successful is the fact that it draws on the local resources and the training is delivered locally. And so beyond the training itself, the officers are making connections and building partnerships with the resources that are available to them locally. That's an important component piece of the training as a whole. At the academy, to basic officers, we train officers from all across the state. And as you know, the resources that are available differ widely depending on where you're located geographically within the state. And some of our fear, perhaps, is that when we looked at, for instance, delivering the 40-hour CIT model to basic recruit officers, is that we would not be able to do that and provide those officers with the experience and the partnerships with the resources that are available to them locally when the training is being delivered at one location centrally in Salem and is meant to apply statewide. Those resources differ dramatically statewide. So we believe that those partnerships are a really integral component piece of the overall training. So we pulled out of the 40-hour Memphis CIT model those pieces that do apply statewide. Regardless of where you are, these component pieces of the training apply. And that is what's being delivered to the basic officers. There's another important piece of that, and that is that to remember that the training it provided at the Basic Academy is just that, basic. And that's what it's intended to be, because the officers who attend the training do not have the experience, do not have the base of knowledge. They don't know what a crisis looks like. And in many respects, the CIT training starts with the assumption that an officer knows what a crisis looks like, knows what that is, has seen it, has perhaps experienced it in the past, and is interested and willing to engage in further training to help them even further identify and appropriately, with the appropriate amount of compassion and sentiment, deal with individuals who suffer from mental illness. Basic officers do not have that base of experience, and so they don't have any context in which to put the training that they receive. They've never seen it. This doesn't, you know, until they get out onto the street or until they go through a significant amount of scenario training, are not going to understand how the training applies. And so we need to make sure that the training at the basic level is, in fact, basic and stays that way, and that we certainly recommend and endorse additional training once officers leave the academy as part of the regional and advanced training component. Because what this bill also does not do is address the 8,000-plus officers who are already out on the streets and who may not have received not only the enhanced version of the current basic curriculum, but any additional training beyond that. And we believe that their needs also need to be addressed. I will be happy to answer any questions that the committee members may have.
Representative Cameron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you put in the hours now, approximately, I know this might be a difficult question, approximately how many hours now that you would consider in your basic training would consider crisis mental health recognition in those scenarios? I know we got to experience some scenarios out there that Representative Flores made some good calls. In those scenarios now, how much, is there a number?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, there is. It's we provide 8 hours of classroom, and then we add on to that classroom training an additional 4 hours, which is role-playing and tabletop exercises designed around that what was learned in that classroom portion. Then additionally, there is another 6 to 8 hours of scenario training that as a component piece or solely, and again, with the officers, the training program is designed around building block and foundational levels. So the initial scenarios that an officer goes through are single issue scenarios, if you will. They walk in, they're fairly straightforward. You're dealing with this particular issue, and in that case, and it would be you're dealing with somebody who is suffering a mental health crisis, and they would have to deal with just that. As the scenarios progress, the scenarios become more and more complex, and that is the training is designed to incorporate as many complex scenarios as possible so that the officers going through the training have to multitask, have to identify from a variety of issues that are present in one single incident, prioritize those issues, and then deal with them appropriately using a wide variety of options. They're not limited solely to what we teach them. They can use any option, any other option that they may think of. And the idea behind that is that we're teaching the officers to think and not simply to react. The training of the past was just that. There is a prescribed response to a given situation. And officers were going out onto the street and really trying to fit their response to a situation into that known box. That is not always appropriate. And so we're trying to now change the training so that it is more well-rounded, so the officers actually have to think their way through the problems and prioritize the issues. And so the scenarios would, as they go through the scenario process, become more complex, and they would deal with more than just a mental health issue. That may be a component or one issue among 4 or 5 issues that are present that the officer has to deal with.
Thank you, Mr. Campbell. So what I wrote down, though, what I heard you say was 8 hours of classroom and then 4 hours of role-playing and then an additional 6 to 8 hours, which could be between 18 and 20 hours now that we are including in the training in the 16-week program that would have mental health recognition scenarios included in that or dedicated towards mental health recognition issues.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, that is absolutely correct.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Campbell, then just taking those numbers, if the current curriculum involves 18 to 20 hours of training and the proposal here is to require 24 hours total, 12 in the classroom and 12 of scenario training, that would be an increase probably in both categories. Well, actually, if role-playing is scenario training, and I'm not sure whether it is, you might offer a comment on that in a moment, but assuming it is, then the current curriculum would be at 10 to 12 hours of scenario training and 8 hours in the classroom. So my question for you is, in addition to confirming what I just summarized, is what would you be eliminating from the curriculum in a 16-week program if this bill were to pass and we were to require an increase in the mental health recognition and intervention?
Chair McPherson, your analysis is correct. And as to what we would eliminate out of the curriculum, I really don't have an answer for that. I don't know. We would go back to the Curriculum Advisory Committee, which is a subcommittee constituted by the board, and work with them on identifying where the cut would be made to the current curriculum. I will also, though, at this take the opportunity to add that oftentimes officers will engage in use of force when they are not confident in their skills. The less confident a person is in their physical skills, the less confident a person is in their in other skills, the more likely they are to engage in a use of force to get the upper hand early on, rather than perhaps wait until a confrontation begins and then, if they're less comfortable with their physical skills, be confident that they could overcome that initial attack. And so any cut to the curriculum, the one obvious question would be, well, let's cut, you know, the number of hours in defensive tactics. Let's cut the number of hours in firearm skills. Let's cut the number of hours elsewhere. 16 weeks is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a long time for basic police training when the national average is 22 weeks. And so we have an awful lot of material crammed into 16 weeks. We have done our best to try and devise a curriculum that maximizes the training value out of those 16 weeks. But in truth, I could not tell you right now where that cut would come. That would be through discussion with the Curriculum Advisory Committee.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Excuse me, and thank you. I'm confused now because, Mr. Cameron, according to your testimony, written testimony on page 2, you indicate that currently there are 8 hours of classroom lecture, 4 hours of classroom role-playing. So that's 12 hours of classroom activity. That's covered in the current bill, which it says 12 hours of classroom training. I think the piece in question, and this is where I'm questioning Chair McPherson, your computation there, says 12 hours of scenario training currently provides 6 to 8 hours of scenario training. So that would indicate there would be an increase in scenario training and not a reduction in classroom training.
Chair McPherson and Representative Flores, the question would really be whether or not the role play and tabletop exercises are considered scenario training or not. Many would consider them, in fact, scenario training. Role playing is a form of scenario. It's hands-on application of the material, and so
you've described it, however, as classroom. Tabletop.
And because for purposes of the discussion here, we wanted to make the distinction that that was not training that was taking place out in the scenario village. But that does not necessarily mean that it's not scenario training in that it's a hands-on application. Quite honestly, we can go either way with it. And that is either add additional scenarios that have a mental illness component to them, and again, it is for that reason that the department has not taken a stand on this bill for or against. We're simply looking for clarification and direction from the committee and others to help us identify where that needs to be. If the feeling is that the role play and the tabletop exercises are in fact part of the scenario training, then there would need to be additional classroom time added to the training, which would result in something else dropping off. Or is that considered part of the classroom and we need therefore to add additional scenarios? That's the direction, quite frankly, that we're looking for from you and from others to help us with.
I would just follow up, Mr. Chair, and comment that I think that would be a determination that you would have to make within the department as to whether that classroom scenario training, as you described it here, is better fit in the classroom category and then enhance the scenario training as the video role plays, which really do amp up your mental engagement and all of that. And I think that's the decision that you might have to make, is what you would need to add to that element in the number of hours.
Chair McPherson, Representative Flores, we absolutely, our initial take would be that that's the right way we would want to go, but we would want to be obviously in compliance with whatever the statute was. And so we would be looking for some help with that. If that was acceptable, that is certainly the route that we would choose to go.
Thank you.
Representative Krieger?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It was mentioned it was 8,000 officers out in the field already. Some of them may or may not have some of this training. On the annual update that they get so many hours a year, would that, this bill doesn't require them to get it, I don't think, it doesn't say that. Would there be possibility that of that annual training, they're updating, they're in service, that this type of thing would be provided for those who are already in the field? That's a greater number of people.
Chairman Pearson, Representative Krieger, it is a greater number of officers. It is entirely possible that, and officers who currently go through the CIT training, I'm sure, certainly use that as part of their maintenance requirement for training every 3 years. They have, in order to maintain their certificate, they have to attend certain amount of training. But it's not specific to this. And so that training, those training hours could come from, could be in any number of topics. It's a number of hours. Our intent would be to try and deliver and coordinate the 40-hour CIT, the full 40-hour CIT model on a regional basis, because that would draw in the local resources. We would use the local resources to help us in the instruction. We would bring in the local service providers. We would bring in the local mental health service consumers to talk to the officers and try and build those partnerships. We have looked at this much in the same way that we looked at child abuse and child abuse training a number of years ago and the formation of the multidisciplinary teams. And we believe that something similar to that model can be applied here in the formation of crisis intervention teams. And that is simply the formation of those partnerships and the understanding between the officers and the resources that are available locally, what they can do, what they can't do, what their hours are, who's available, all of those things that do differ between one location and another around the state, and build those partnerships on the regional level and do that through our regional and advanced training section.
Just a follow-up comment. The bill isn't that far off from what's being taught already. So my concern would be maybe more with the 8,000 that don't have any training at this time that are out there, and there's no direct plan to require anything. I'd rather address that 8,000 because these are people that have formed habits as police officers, good or bad, and they need to be brought up to date with the newest sciences regarding mental health. When I went to the academy, I never got an hour of it. Of course, that was some time ago.
Before.
Chair.
Let's give a
representative
comp, and then
I'll comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair, for all of us. I feel uncomfortable with mandating a curriculum. If I was in the opposite chair here as a school principal, if I had this committee telling me how many minutes of PE I needed to do in my school, how many minutes of health, and because I would be uncomfortable making a decision on this today without knowing the fuller curriculum. I just have concerns. I mean, the people in the field are the experts. I'm not. So I don't feel comfortable with making a real tough decision like this.
And Representative Flores.
Thank you. And just in regard to the officers that are out in the field, I know there are successful models for the county sheriffs in Clackamas County. They have training, and they have provided a successful model for how that training can be accomplished out in the field. So I think that is goes a long way to accomplishing the training of those officers who are have not currently received the benefit of what the department does offer.
Okay, if there are no further questions or comments, let's excuse Mr. Campbell. We've got several more people who have signed up to testify on this bill, and I'm going to urge them to come forward. I think maybe we'll bring a couple here together, Michael Morris from DHS and Bob Jundef. And I would urge the people presenting this point, because we have two more bills set for hearing yet today, which we want to get on to. So be fairly brief. I think that focusing in on whether we should be legislating a specific number of hours on what is obviously a very important area of understanding that our law enforcement people need to have, is whether this is the right solution for getting at that problem.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, my name is Mike Morris. I'm the Mental Health Policy Manager for Addictions Mental Health Division, Department of Human Services. And I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2765 for many of the reasons that have already been said in regards to the issues of that officers encounter out on the streets. We also support the idea of using scenario training, especially when that involves bringing in family members and also individuals with psychiatric disabilities to assist in that training. And that in the crisis intervention training, that has been a very valuable aspect of that training. And believe that also the increase to 24 hours would be a step in the right direction, as well as the local efforts to provide crisis intervention team training. So we just feel that this training would start officers off on the right step in providing information regarding mental illnesses and increase their awareness and sensitivity and take a step in combating the stigma that is out there in our general public regarding mental illness. And thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Let's go to Mr. Joondeff, and then we'll open for questions.
Chairman McPherson, members of the committee, my name is Bob Joondeff from Oregon Advocacy Center. I really have two simple points, and one is that the proposal before you is completely consistent with policy that has been developing over the last 10 years, both nationally and locally. I've been involved with a number of bodies, both nationally and locally, that have supported type of training that this bill would be requiring. So it's not new, and it's been proven to work both locally and more broadly in other states. The second point I wanted to make is just the message that this bill would send is that after the Chassis incident in Portland, I received numerous phone calls and letters, emails from families and people with mental illness. And the message that they had for me was a very sad message, which was that they, for both their children, their family members, and for themselves, they were afraid of being on the streets of Portland, and they were afraid of being on the streets not because of the chance of being victimized by criminals, but because of police officers, the very people who were there charged with their protection. And I think that's a very sad thing. And I think that this bill would send a message that's not where we want to be as a society. Now, as to your question as to whether 24 hours is the right number, if there's another number, or what the role of legislation should be, the models that I have seen actually would support a greater number of hours than this. I think this is a modest beginning. However, I acknowledge the fact that we really want to create partnerships here where we are bringing mental health and law enforcement together to decide what's the best way to train, what's the most effective way to train. I've been involved with the Portland Police Force in terms of how they have develop their training, and it has evolved over the years in terms of what they feel is the best and most effective way. So I guess my response to your question is I think this is a good start in terms of establishing state policy that this type of training is effective and needed, and it may take some more development in order to determine what's the most effective way to do that. And what mechanism might encourage that is something that I might have to return to you with an opinion about.
Okay. Representative Cameron.
Thank you. Thank you for testifying for us this morning. Have you, either of you gentlemen, gone over to DP, I always get the initials, DPSST, and observed the scenario training, the 16 to 18 hours that we just were hearing testimony and watch what they're doing currently?
Chair, Representative Cameron, the last time I was there, I would say it was about 15 years ago.
Oh.
So I haven't, in discussing this topic, actually, so I haven't seen their most recent practices.
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, our staff have reviewed the curriculum that they are using over there. I don't know of anybody who's specifically gone over and observed the training.
Thank you. What's your staff's opinion of the curriculum they're using now and recommendations that would change? And my concern, let me just clarify, my concerns is that You know, I've gone through training programs. I'll go through a day seminar, and I'm lucky if I walk away with, you know, one nugget of gold from that and apply it in my life. My concern is that we overwhelm people with, you know, 18 or 24 hours. You know, there's a lot more to this than just a bill that says we got to have 24 hours of training. I know here in Marion County, we have Sheriff Ramirez has worked real hard to send people back into training for 40 hours, but it's after they've had time to understand and become confident in other areas. So my concern is pushing out a piece of policy that maybe already, in fact, is happening. And if it's been 15 years since we reviewed what they're doing, I'd like to hear a little bit more about, you know, what's reality going on over there versus this bill that we're looking at today.
I don't think that necessarily requires a response, and so unless you had something particular to offer.
I would like a response on if they've reviewed his staff. We said staff has reviewed it. What's their assessment of what they reviewed and recommendations they would make to change it?
Right. Chair McPherson and Representative Cameron, the staff reviewed the curriculum, and one of the things that they noticed is that the curriculum covers not only mental illnesses but also other disabilities, so that time is shared with other issues besides mental illness. And the staff did also comment, as I said, is that the inclusion of individuals with a psychiatric disability in family members is very crucial and very impactful, and really allows officers to see the face of individuals with a mental illness.
One more for me.
Okay.
You're going to turn my microphone off.
If we could, we need to. We got a couple more people yet on this bill, and so we need to.
Yeah. In Representative Olson's testimony, House Bill 3524 would create a voluntary means of family members and custodial treatment to provide information into LEDS. Is your organization supportive of that bill, and have you looked at it to help officers with another tool?
Chair McPherson, Representative Cameron, we did testify in support of the bill with just wanting to make sure that the confidentiality issues are addressed. Also, is this kind of component is also key to provide officers information about when they see a diagnosis on a database or a mental illness, that they understand what that means and that it doesn't feed stigma but actually educates and informs the officer the best way to approach the individual.
Mr. Chair, Representative Cameron, we oppose that bill, but just for a variety of technical problems in the bill, we agree with the idea that giving officers information that would be useful for them is a good thing. The bill had, in our estimation, had some problems in terms of how it does that, and we offered to sit down and work on ways to minimize those problems.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, committee. Thank you, gentlemen. There are two more witnesses signed up, and I'll ask them to come up together, Mary Botkin and Christina White.
I'll be very brief for the record. I'm Mary Botkin, representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. We represent folks starting with 911, LEDS, corrections, some officers on the street. We are here in support of this bill for as far as it goes. We think it doesn't quite get as far as it should get. We actually think it ought to say public safety officers rather than police officers. And it should cover everybody, not just street officers. And that everybody from the person who answers a 911 call ought to have as much information as possible about the response that they're going to and what they're dealing with when they're getting there. We're in favor of some sort of a LEDS flag, as we are in support of a flag for mentally ill inmates. We think that officers respond differently when they know what they're dealing with when they get to the scene. Having said all of that, in looking at the relating to clause, I don't think there's anything you can do with this because the relating to clause is so narrow and so specific. But I do know that we're working with Representative Shields down in Public Safety Sub to try and get more money set aside within the public safety budgets to allow for training. You know, we don't need a bill to do the training. What we need is the funding. And that's the bottom line. John Minnis, tomorrow morning, can say, I'm going to do 40 hours of training, and I'm going to reconfigure my training curriculum to meet that. The issue is, does he have the funding and does he have the trainers? And so I'm going to continue to work on the budget side and let the certified smart people behind me work on the policy side. I do have a copy of Clackamas County Sheriff's CIT training. I think it is superb. And I used it as an example when I worked with Max Williams and his committee for the major mental illness in prison task force that he put together. I mean, Bob Junedep is right. This is not a new issue. We're all trying to deal with it. And I know you're in a hurry, and I'm going to stop talking. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Botkin. Ms. White.
Chair McPherson and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Christina White. I'm the legislative aide of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs. And AOC MHP enthusiastically supports House Bill 2765 and encourages you to endorse. The House Bill 2765 as an important part of supporting the mental health system. Crisis intervention training is a model program that all enforcement officers should have as part of their basic training. While the standard CIT curriculum is 40 hours, we are supportive of the 24 hours of training as a step to enhance current minimum training standards for basic police certification. As you know, about 20% of the people in our jails have a mental illness, and there have been several tragedies, both officers and persons with mental illness alike. These situations could have potentially been avoided if there had been was adequately funded community mental health system, crisis respite care centers, and our law enforcement officers had the appropriate training to recognize mental illness and triage a crisis. I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify on this bill, and I would be glad to answer any questions.
Any question for Ms. White? Representative Cameron.
Mary, I'll see you this afternoon.
Yes, you will. But we're doing the state
budget.
Police.
Yeah.
We're just doing the state police now. That's, you know.
Representative Flores.
Very quickly, thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Botkin, you indicated we don't need a bill to do the training. We need the funding, and we need to focus on the ways and means. Perhaps you heard Senator Gordley testify earlier that last session there was money set aside for this very type of training. So what type of enhancement are we talking about, or could you just kind of elaborate on that a little bit more?
You know, I don't have hard numbers, Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, and I apologize for that, but as I work with the new co-chair, or the new chair of public safety, I'm actually meeting with him tomorrow to see if we can't put some numbers in some enhanced training programs internally. I know that Max Williams reconfigured, I mean, we worked with him to reconfigure the budget, so we now do 4 hours of training in-house dedicated to mental health training for our corrections staff. You know, I think, I sort of feel like everybody else does. I don't know what the right number is. What I do know is what we're doing isn't adequate. We've had too many tragedies, both officer injuries as well as inmate injuries and death as a result of the lack of training. And, you know, we just continue to work through this process with folks like Bob Junedep trying to find the magic mix of what it takes to handle a population that's being dumped on us. I mean, we don't think 30% of the inmates who are mentally ill ought to be there. But there isn't anywhere else to put them, so that's where they are. And we don't think the streets is an appropriate response either. So, I don't know what you do, but we're just committed to continue to work through that process and to find the leftover money, if you will, to spend on in as much training as we can for the officers. I mean, we're looking at putting together some specialized response teams. We have response teams for cell extractions, for fire suppression, for, you know, every other known thing. We ought to have special response teams for mental health crisis inside the prison. We don't have that yet. Again, it's a funding issue, and so I think that, you know, we're just working our way through that. And the budget has not been worked yet, as Representative Cameron knows. So when the budget starts getting worked, I'll be in the front row.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Mary, I'm just going to argue with you. It shouldn't be leftover funding. It should be the top priority.
Well,
thank you.
Representative Cameron, I would agree with you, but, you know, leftover, I'll take the leftovers, too. Thank you.
Any further questions? Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and I'd just like to make a comment if we have, as we have just a moment here. I'm hopeful that this bill will have the support at this of the committee, whether it's today or to bring it back for further vetting. In the same context of mandates, and I think I did a sidebar conversation with Representative Comp. You know, within the Department of Education, we set standards and require so many hours of students to complete an education, I mean, in English and science and math and in various fundamental educational elements. I think that this is somewhat the same thing. We don't dictate how that happens at the local level, but we give them instruction as to what is required. And I see this bill as the same type of thing, less a mandate, but an instruction. You should accomplish this, especially since it has come to the surface as such a very significant need in our society today. So I'm hopeful that we'll be able to move this forward at a near point in time.
Okay. Any further comments?
I'm sorry if I missed this, but I was thinking about the comment that Representative Comp made about the curriculum, and I wonder if it's perhaps better to just have 24 hours rather than 12 and 12, and then that sort of gives the DPSST the ability to determine whether they should have, you know, 11 and 13, or I trust them to figure out the best use of the 24 hours as long as that 24 hours is going toward the mental health training. So I think maybe I'd feel more comfortable with that if that would help with Representative Thompson.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, along those lines, hearing testimony of some of the mental health professionals saying that, well, it's interwoven with other scenarios. I mean, you know, you can't, I don't see how you pull out, okay, now this next scenario I'm going to go through is a mental health versus the last room I walked into was a guy on drugs, because we saw how, you know, some of the scenarios are trained. So my concern, and I'm going to follow up here, is if it's 24 hours, is that, I mean, how do you measure 24 hours of mental health recognition within training and recognition within, as a police officer, all the other things I'm dealing with? So I just really have a problem with mandating this. And if we could come up with some way that just says we have a policy that we continue to include, expand mental health training at the, you know, or have them report back what they're doing, that's what I think we're talking about here, to me.
Chair, the option is it's what Representative Flores and I was talking about. But what we want in all training and education is what did you learn? What's your outcome? It's not how much time it takes to reach that. It's you want people to be competent in recognizing the signs and the symptoms.
Good point.
And so, yeah, maybe the hour thing isn't the what we want. It's we want it to have competent people out there serving our public. So,
and I'll just comment, and it's going to be a lot different for an officer who's working in Toledo, Oregon, as opposed to Multnomah County or Portland or Salem or Clackamas County. And so I think I will not move to a work session today. We just need, but that being said, it's vital that they get this component in there, and maybe we shouldn't dictate 12 and 12 or whatever. We'll have to take another look at that, but we're going to have to, I'll speak with the chairman, we're going to have to get this thing moving as this session's rolling right along, and we've got to get a piece of this out there. It obviously is vital from the testimony we've heard. It just, now it's like, yeah, we've got to have it, but what does it look like? And so we want to give the John Menace's crew a chance to develop the training that they believe would do the job the best for rounds. Okay, close the public hearing on House Bill 2765 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2869.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2869 extends the time period that a sheriff has to sell property pursuant to garnishment to 20 days, authorizes a sheriff to serve a fax copy of an eviction summons and complaint, authorizes law enforcement agencies to forcibly enter specified premises to enforce an order of assistance pertaining to custody or to enforce a Family Abuse Prevention Act custody provision. Also authorizes a sheriff to serve and enter into the law enforcement data system a fax copy of restraining orders. It also establishes that the court modification to a restraining order that lessens restrictions upon a respondent does not need to be served on the respondent. However, the proposed -2 amendment deletes the establishment that the court modification to a restraining order that lessens restrictions does not need to be served upon the respondent. Declares an emergency, making the act effective upon passage. And committee members should also have the -1 amendment, which deletes the phrase summons and complaint and replaces it with restraining order in three places in the bill.
Okay, thank you. I have one person signed up, and if you want to bring anybody else up, Rob Bovet. Probably said that wrong.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Rob Ovett, wearing my hat as basically legislative advisor to the Civil Division of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And in the interest of time, I will make this incredibly brief. Every couple of sessions, if you didn't already know, the Civil Division of Sheriff's Offices is basically the enforcement arm of the courts. So without the Civil Division, the paper that the courts issue is just that, it's paper. The law involved with the Civil Division, civil process, execution of writs, foreclosure, is technical and intricate. And thankfully today, if you have any questions about all the details of this bill, and counsel did a very good job summarizing it, and we've also provided you a one-page section-by-section explanation of the purpose for each of these sections. But if you do actually have technical questions, I have brought the entire command council of the Civil Division of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. And these are essentially the brain trust for Oregon about all these technical intricacies. What happens is every couple of the sessions, two or three sessions, these folks get together and they get together with me, and we do something we hadn't been doing prior to about 10 years ago, which is doing just basic technical improvements, law improvements, dealing with new technologies, evolving case law, and do modifications and improvements on a technical side. So it's not a very sexy bill, and I know it's crammed between two very high-priority, policy-level bills. In brief, in turn, we also have, in addition to the four civil leaders we have listed on the testimony, Brian Wallace from Marion County, the fifth member of the Command Council, is also here. So we have the entire brain trust from the Civil Division. And in terms of the -1 amendments, the -1 amendments are basically my fault. It's a cut-and-paste technical error that I failed to catch in the LC draft, so that's a friendly amendment should be moved into the bill. The -2 amendments, a legitimate concern was raised by the Judicial Department, and we addressed that by excising a particular subsection that was unnecessary and remedied that issue. So I would urge you to move both the -1s and the -2s into the bill as friendly amendments to clarify those issues. And with that, in the interest of time, I will, essentially shut up. But if you do have questions, I will likely draw on one or more of the people sitting in the front row.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? Representative Flores.
Thank you. Excuse me, very quickly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bovet, in regard to the facsimile transmission of these restraining orders and summons and complaints and so on, how do you guard against a potential folly? It's pretty easy to have a form and have it with a pretty scrawled signature to indicate that a judge has signed something, and And how do you do the verification process to make sure this is, in fact, transmitted by the trial court administrator?
Mr. Chair, Representative Flores, I have a short answer to that, which is we're really talking about facsimile transmissions as between the trial court administrator and the sheriff's office. But I will turn to the expertise back here and see if anybody has something they want to elaborate further on.
And just identify yourself for the record.
Fletcher Barker, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Senior Deputy Ross with the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office. Fletcher Barker, Representative Flores, in this bill, it's required that the facsimile be of a certified copy and only transmitted by a deputy court administrator or a sheriff to someone who's already said they are able to receive the facsimile. So there is already telephonic communication between these two parties, and these are officers of the court to begin with, so that's one safeguard we put in against bogus facsimiles.
Quick follow-up?
Yes.
So as I read this, someone has to verify that there is a facsimile communication device available. So does that mean that every time a document is transmitted, a phone call is made and said, do you have your fax machine available? And that's from the trial court administrator or their designee?
Vice Chair Barker, Representative Flores, that is correct. We envision this as an exigent circumstance, not a routine occurrence, where we want somebody talking to someone else, knowing which fax machine it's going and knowing that it's going to a waiting recipient.
Thank you.
Okay, are there further questions? Okay, thank you. Public hearing on House Bill 2869. Open a work session on House Bill 2869. We have two amendments. Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the dash one and dash two into the bill.
Representative Wisnant moves dash one and dash two into House Bill 2869. Are there any objections? Okay. So moved. They're in, and if I could have a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the committee pass House Bill 2869 to the floor, but do pass recommendation.
As amended.
As amended, thank you, and probably placed on the consent agenda.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, is there any concerns about the consent agenda? Representative Wisnett has moved House Bill 2869 as amended to the floor with the due pass to be placed on the consent calendar. Call the roll, please.
Aye.
Aye.
Ms. Flores.
Aye.
Ms.
Scott. Aye.
Ms. Krieger.
Excused.
Ms.
Krieger. Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chairman.
Excused. House Bill 2869, as amended, is passed. Thank you. Public hearing on House Bill 3336. And Representative Gelser, please.
Thank you, Vice Chair Barker and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sarah Gelser, and I'm the state representative from House District 16, which includes the portions of Benton County that include Corvallis and Philomath. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today in support of House Bill 3336. This is an important bill to me for a variety of reasons, but it was also the first bill drafting request that I put into legislative council back in January of 2006, shortly after being appointed to the legislature. At that time, that initial bill, Oregon Advocacy Center had some concerns, and so it was redrafted into the bill that you see today. And I'd also like to offer my thanks to Kevin Neely and the Oregon District Attorney's Association, who has come to me with other concerns. I understand there might be some other concerns from other organizations, but I have not had the opportunity to be contacted by those organizations yet. If passed, this bill will codify the Supreme Court's 2002 decision in Atkins versus Virginia that it is unconstitutional to execute individuals with mental retardation. To that end, this bill in Section 2 explicitly states no person with mental retardation is eligible for the death penalty. Although there is general agreement among prosecutors, defense attorneys, and advocates for and against the death penalty that no one would knowingly pursue a death sentence against a defendant with mental retardation, questions remain about how, when, and by whom the determination of mental retardation should be made. This is another issue. This is an issue that other states have grappled with in the wake of the 2002 Supreme Court decision, and many have passed legislation answering these questions. The legislation that I bring to you today is very consistent with the legislation passed in the eight other states who have codified the Atkins decision. I want to be very clear that this bill is not about the death penalty or the merits or demerits of imposition of a death sentence. This is simply about the most efficient, fair, and true way to make what is really a medical diagnosis. This bill does not change the currently accepted definition of mental retardation, which is found in ORS 427.005, which reads that mental retardation means significantly subaverage general intellectual functioning existing concurrently with deficits in adaptive behavior and manifested during the developmental period. Persons of borderline intelligence may be considered mentally retarded if there is also serious impairment of adaptive behavior. This definition is used not just in courts, but also for provision of our human service programs and many of our education programs, which is one of the reasons this bill does not seek to change the definition. It is important when reflecting on that definition and the actual experience of mental retardation to remember that mental retardation is more than just an IQ score. Rather, intelligence and adaptive skills together must be evaluated in order to determine whether or not a person meets the criteria for a diagnosis of mental retardation. It is a diagnosis that must be made by a skilled professional who understands the complexities of a mental retardation diagnosis and knows how to use objective data to make a reasoned, fair, and true diagnosis. This bill seeks to remove the politically and emotionally charged issue of the death penalty and the crimes which would cause a prosecutor to seek the death penalty from this medical diagnosis for an individual. If passed, this bill would place the burden of proof on the defendant, who must show with a preponderance of the evidence that he or she has mental retardation. The defendant would need to notify the court 90 days prior to the trial of the intent to assert mental retardation. At this point, the judge would appoint two psychologists, experts in the diagnosis of mental retardation, who would each independently evaluate the defendant. They would present their findings and their determination of whether or not the person has mental retardation to the judge. At this time, the state and the defense would have the ability to examine the reports and ask questions of the examiners. The judge would then rule on the question of mental retardation. If a person is determined to have mental retardation, the trial would move forward, but the death penalty would not be a sentencing option, given that at that point it would be unconstitutional. If the person is not found to have mental retardation, the trial would move forward as it would for any other criminal defendant. Some have asked and argued why this should be done pre-trial. They argue that the diagnosis of mental retardation is a question of fact, which should be determined by a jury during the sentencing phase. I disagree. Mental retardation is a medical diagnosis. It is not appropriate to ask a jury, after hearing the facts of a heinous crime and making a conviction on that crime for that defendant, to then weigh the merits of a medical diagnosis. Medical diagnosis should be left to professionals and should be considered absent the facts of the crime. Most state legislatures who have enacted legislation to this issue have agreed. Most of the states that have enacted legislation in response to the Atkins case have adopted laws that direct the determination of mental retardation to be made pre-trial and by a judge. States have indicated several reasons for doing this. Because people with mental retardation have a constitutional protection from the death penalty, it only makes sense to determine that diagnosis before the trial in order to save the unnecessary additional expense related to conducting a capital case. Further, making the arguments to the judge in the mental retardation determination is less costly than running a jury proceeding. Finally, a judge is less likely to be persuaded by issues irrelevant to the diagnosis, such as the facts of the crime or opinions about the death penalty, than a jury. It has been the experience of states that have had mental retardation statutes for several years that when the issue of mental retardation has been resolved prior to trial, a considerable number of cases can be resolved by pleas, saving the state the cost of a full trial. Since the Atkins ruling in 2002, 8 additional states have enacted legislation codifying the Supreme Court's decision. Of the states that explicitly discuss when the determination is made, 7 of those 8 enacted legislation that called for the pretrial determination of mental retardation. Only the state of Virginia calls for a jury to make the determination during sentencing, so just 1 out of 8 after the Atkins decision. Most of these states require the determination also to be made by a judge. 18 additional states and the federal government already had statutory language prohibiting the execution of people with mental retardation prior to the Atkins decision. Because that legislation was enacted before people with mental retardation were recognized to have constitutional protection from the death penalty, the language is not clear as to when the determination is made among those state statutes. The Atkins case provides clear direction that people with mental retardation have constitutional protection from the death penalty. Given this, it would make sense that Oregon would follow the lead of most states who have taken action and ensure that no person constitutionally ineligible for capital punishment be put through a capital trial. Given the gravity of this protection, it also makes sense that the matter of this medical diagnosis be handled by a judge with the explicit input of a third party, medical professionals, who are qualified to evaluate cognitive disabilities such as mental retardation. If the legislature is unable to act this session on the question of when and by whom the determination is made, I do hope that we can at least adopt the language on page 3, line 35. No person with mental retardation is eligible for the death penalty. This is constitutionally true, and we should join the 26 states and the federal government in codifying this in Oregon law. I'm happy to answer any questions, and I do hope that you will move forward on this legislation.
Thank you, Representative Gelser. Are there any questions? Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Gelser. Very thorough, and you always do your homework, and I appreciate your passion for these issues very much. In your reference, in your written testimony, and then in Section 2 of the bill, page 3, line 37, about the notice to the court, the defendant shall file notice with the court of that intention at least 90 days prior to trial unless just cause for a later filing date is shown. And what would you anticipate would be perhaps just cause to file later than the 90 days, closer to trial?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Flores, I will confess to not being an attorney, but rather someone that likes to watch Law and Order on occasion. However, I would imagine that would happen when a trial was scheduled with less than 90 days from the time the person was charged. So if you're charged with a crime and you have to submit notice 90 days beforehand, but you only know your trial is coming 45 days ahead of time, it seems like there should be some leeway there.
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Gelser, for bringing this bill forward. And I'm asking you a question that hopefully you can answer. If not, I hope somebody else, perhaps the criminal defense attorneys here, could answer. In the states that have enacted the requirement that the determination be made by a judge, have defendants asserted that they have a right to a jury trial and would be willing to waive it perhaps for a judge, but I wonder if defendants are saying we want the right to a jury trial on this issue.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I was not able to find that had happened in the literature that I had studied leading up to this. One of them was Mental Retardation and the Death Penalty, a Guide to State Legislative Issues, which did a review of the states that have enacted this legislation. So I am not aware of that issue. I could imagine that some people would make that argument. However, my response to that would be, again, to go back to this isn't an issue of leveling or tilting a playing field for the prosecution or the defense. This isn't about the prosecution of the crime. It's about whether or not an individual has a medical diagnosis. I do not believe that juries are capable of making a medical diagnosis. I believe that's a diagnosis that should be made by a professional physician And we put those protections in so that the judge himself also isn't making that decision in the absence of these medical opinions that are coming to him. The intent is to remove the facts of the case from what is a medical diagnosis.
Thank you, Representative. And follow up, I hope somebody's here to testify about that issue and whether that's a part of the constitutional right to a jury trial, never having practiced criminal law. I don't know that.
Several perspectives yet to hear from.
Yeah. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, may I add that in the states that have done this, it does not, if the individual is unsuccessful, if the individual is successful and the judge determines that they have mental retardation, in other states as they move forward, that does not preclude the individual from raising the issue of mental retardation as a contributing fact to the crime later on. So that doesn't remove that from the conversation, whether or not the determination of mental retardation is made. The determination of mental retardation is addressed in this bill applies only to whether or not the individual is eligible for the death penalty.
Thank you.
Just a quick question, Chair. Thank you. Representative Gelser, thank you. Have you worked with the psychologists and the psychiatrists with this bill? Because we heard another bill a week or so ago, and it wasn't about the death penalty, but it was about predetermination. And so I just didn't know if you've been working with them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Comp, I have not. In terms of the definition, I had stuck with the definition that was currently in law, partly because untangling the current definition of mental retardation in Oregon statute would be a very difficult process that would need to involve the educational community, the DHS community, advocates for people with developmental disabilities and mental retardation. In the past, when changes have been made to a definition for mental retardation, it can have a very significant impact on services to people in other areas. One of the best quotes I ever read about that was, with the stroke of a pen, a person can suddenly, who's been mentally retarded for 20 years, suddenly isn't anymore. Or someone who had previously been considered to have normal intelligence is suddenly mentally retarded. It's a pretty profound switch.
Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. And I don't know any place, well, maybe Texas, but where somebody would want to execute a retarded person. But The question I have, even though I'm signing on the bill, I'm not in agreement that a judge should be picking somebody prior to the trial. And this is going to be marginal cases. I mean, if somebody's obviously retarded, you know, they'll be looking at that clearly. But this is where somebody has a questionable defendant. They're going to want to argue that. And a judge decides questions of the law, and a jury decides questions of fact. And I would disagree with your perception that a jury couldn't make that decision. They would be based on medical evidence. But, I mean, you would still have somebody. And I'm somewhat concerned about who would be appointing. I mean, if I said to you, this is a good bill, we'll just put in Josh Marquis will pick the psychologist. And you could tell me a judge's name and I'd have the same reaction every way. And that's my concern. It's easy in a board I served on, a disability and pension board. I objected to having one certain psychologist who would evaluate people. If I was trying to go off on a stress claim, I could go to him and say, I want to go off on a stress claim, pay him to do the diagnosis, and I'd be nuttier than a fruitcake. If, on the other hand, I said I'm going to go off on a stress claim and the board hired that doctor to evaluate me, I'd be sane as, you know, and so not, and most, I think most psychologists are very above that and don't do that. But there are there are people who will go with the bucks or whatever, and that's my concern. And I think that if in a questionable case you should go ahead and go to trial, and then this evidence would come up and then the jury would decide on that at the end.
Mr. Chair,
and what I would urge is we've got several more people we want to hear from here. We've got maybe in 4 and 15 minutes, so I would say rather than maybe the sort of the discussion of the merits. I don't want to cut you off, Representative. You had a brief response, yes. But I think what we need to do is to hear from all the perspectives we can today.
Sure. If it pleases you, Mr. Chair, I'd like to give a brief response. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Barker. I could, if the committee felt that it was appropriate, I'm not opposed as much to having the jury make the determination if it is before the trial. It does not make sense to me that a jury who has already heard the facts of the case and convicted the defendant would make a medical diagnosis in the context having already heard the heinous details of the crime. It's a medical decision that has nothing to do with the facts of the crime. That said, I think that another reason it is important to ensure that you are as narrowly medical in making this diagnosis as possible, it does impact a very narrow population of people, but it's a narrow population of people that is going to be expanding. The population of individuals who have mild mental retardation is expanding as you see the impacts of methamphetamine on individuals who are getting older, where it's questionable whether or not it is mental retardation or not. I'm concerned that these are the cases that are going to come forward where there's going to be a question. And if you move forward and convict someone who does have mental retardation and give them a capital punishment, a capital sentence, the cost of pursuing those appeals, of denying their constitutional rights because they are a person with mental retardation, I think would be very costly. To me, it makes sense to avoid the cost of a capital prosecution by determining before the trial, even if that is, I could concede on the jury versus the judge as long as it's before the trial and not after that jury's heard the heinous facts of the case.
The person can waive a jury. I mean, you know, in those cases, the state has the right to have them tried by a jury.
That's, if there are no pressing other items, let's excuse Representative Gelsler. Thank you very much. Let's go to Rich Wolf from OCDLA.
I don't think you can see. I don't want a jury request. They want you to have one in it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Rich Wolf. I'm a lawyer in private practice in Portland. I've been practicing in Oregon for 20 years. I've defended capital cases, my first one in 1994. I've tried them to juries. I've argued them before the Oregon Supreme Court, before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and last term, Solicitor General Williams and I argued one before the Supreme Court of the United States. I also have the distinction, I think, of being the only lawyer in the state, at least since the Atkins decision, to have handled a case, a capital case, which involved a mentally retarded defendant. And I appreciate the representative's introduction of this bill, and it's one that is long overdue. I do, however, believe that there are some concerns that I'd like to express with particulars of the bill, and they've been touched on here already this morning. First of all, I'd like to, in response to Representative Barker's comments, the case that I had in Multnomah County involved an individual who, now this case spanned pre-Atkins, before the Atkins ruling came down, and the case continued after the Atkins ruling had been handed down by the Supreme Court. And in the context of a competency hearing about whether my client was competent or not to stand trial, the trial judge found that he was mildly mentally retarded, yet marginally competent. Nevertheless, the prosecution proceeded as a capital prosecution. This is after the decision in Atkins. So to say that these cases won't proceed once we know someone's mentally retarded is contrary to my experience. So on the other hand, I do think it is important for there to be a pretrial determination of whether or not an individual is mentally retarded, and it's appropriate for the judge to make that legal determination, because we know from the Supreme Court ruling that mental retardation is a categorical exclusion from the death penalty. So, not unlike someone who is under the age of 18. If they're not 18 years of age at the time of the crime, they are categorically excluded from the death penalty. Now, my concern about the legislation is, if in the event the trial judge does conclude that the defendant is not mentally retarded, we believe that constitutionally the jury still needs to have the opportunity to make the factual determination of whether or not that person suffers from mental retardation, thereby excluding them from a possible death sentence. So with the understanding that the legislation moves in the right direction and that it bars mental retardation, someone suffering from that, from being eligible for a death sentence, we think it's also important that there be a bifurcated approach. And the representative who has introduced the legislation was reading from a guide to state legislation by Professor James Ellis. He's the Regents Professor of Law at the University of New Mexico, who argued the Atkins case before the Supreme Court. And he offers two alternatives. And one of the alternatives is that a trial judge makes a pretrial determination of whether or not there's mental retardation. If there's not, then the case proceeds as a non-capital case. If the judge makes a determination that, if the judge finds that he is mentally retarded, the case ends there as far as death not being an option. It proceeds as a non-capital case. If the judge finds he is not mentally retarded, then the jury goes on to consider the issue. And regarding this fact, Professor Ellis says, this bifurcated approach to the issue may at first appear awkward to some legislators, and some prosecutors may initially be concerned that it offers the defendant two bites at the apple. But the bifurcation makes sense because its two prongs address two separate, although factually related, questions. The first to be addressed by the judge is the legal issue of whether the defendant is a person who is eligible for the death penalty. If the court does not find the defendant death eligible because of mental retardation, it would be unconstitutional to proceed with a capital trial. The second inquiry by the jury is whether the prosecution has demonstrated that the defendant is factually an individual upon whom the death penalty may be imposed. Condemning a defendant to death who has properly raised the issue of mental retardation then becomes contingent on the finding of fact that is a necessary precondition to a capital sentence. So just as if there was an issue about how old an individual was at the time of the commission of the crime, it would be essential for the jury to make that determination. It would be incumbent upon the prosecution to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant is or was 18 years of old age at the time of the commission of the crime, just as it would be important for them to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant does not suffer from mental retardation. So with those clarifications, so in other words, I think that the bill is well-intentioned. It's good legislation. We definitely need it. We're 5 years after the Atkins decision, and I can tell you that we out there in the field in the trial courts, we're really just floundering in the dark as to how we do proceed with these cases. I've had two other lawyers, from one from Clackamas County and one from Benton County, contact me concerning my experience with the case in 2002, where they had a defendant who they believed was mentally retarded, and there's really no guidelines or procedures by which trial courts are to determine, by which prosecutors, defense lawyers, or trial judges are to, how we're to make these determinations. So,
Mr. Wolf, thank you very much. What I'd like to do, we have Brad Berry from the district attorneys, and I'd like to get him up here before we run out of time, and we really only have 5 minutes, so I want to make sure we have an opportunity to hear his perspective on these. So unless there's a pressing need to ask a question here.
No, and just a comment, Mr. Chair, as Mr. Bradbury's coming forward, I think it would be helpful for us to have the document that Representative Gelser referenced and Mr. Wolf referenced on the paper for the background paper that the attorney who handled the Atkins case for our review.
Barry. Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I'm Brad Berry. I'm the Yamhill County District Attorney. I, too, chair the Oregon District Attorneys Association Legislative Committee. House Bill 3336 is a bill that has essentially been before the legislature a couple of times before, and the principal part of it with requiring or having a process that is pretrial is one, to be brief, that causes us the most concern from the DA's Association. We have had big discussions about whether or not there is a constitutional requirement that a jury ultimately make this decision. I know that continues to be a big debate, but if in fact ultimately the jury needs to make that determination, then exactly what Mr. Wolf was talking about creates our big fear, and that's that we're going to be trying this issue at least twice. That would be pretrial as well as what we've referred to as a fifth question in the penalty phase after a defendant has been found guilty of the particular crime, and then you go on to the penalty phase. The we all know the capital cases are very expensive. We all know that that certainly defendants are entitled to the best defense they can have, but they ought not to be in a position where we try the same issue over and over. Putting it before the jury as a fifth question or something like a fifth question, candidly, as an aside, I've looked at it maybe as a first question, that the jury looks at it if, in fact, they find that a person is mentally retarded, significantly mentally retarded. I have taken issue with two of the those who provided testimony talking mild retardation. That's not what the case law would exclude from at least the consideration of the jury. But to put it out there twice is the thing that we're concerned about. If you make it something akin to the first question, the jury determines that a person is mentally retarded, then they don't go further to determining whether or not the person is eligible for capital punishment. They'd be looking at the other alternatives within our capital system, that being of true life or life with the possibility of parole after 30 years. In other words, they take it off the table. If you find mentally retarded, you skip to the last question, although they'll still be considering the same types of evidence through the rest of the penalty phase and making that decision. The comments have been made that juries should not be put in the position of dealing with these issues, and I would suggest that jurors always or often are put in the position of looking at mental defects of defendants. They do it for the purposes of defenses, and they have always done it for the purposes of mitigating factors in determining an appropriate sentence in capital cases. It's something they do currently, and they have always done. I am trying to be very brief. I brought lots of notes, and I'm not going to get to a quarter of them. In sum, I think it is important, one, that if this is, we know this is a constitutional protection for those who are mentally retarded. We have great concerns that, in fact, a jury will have to make that decision. Ultimately, that will be the decision of the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's best to do it once that's in the penalty phase.
Okay. Any questions for Mr. Berry?
Yeah, you have us dumbfounded.
Thank you, Mr. Berry.
Thank
you for your patience in coming. We have just like a minute left here, and I have two more people who had signed up, Mary Williams from the Department of Justice and Bob Jundeff. And I guess what I would ask is there information either of you would think we ought to have today, or recognizing we're not going to be moving the bill today, is that input that can be taken offline for whatever further work is done? Mr. Jundeff?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just what I'd like to say is that I've been involved with these bills over the years. I think the issues that have just been framed for you by the other witnesses are the issues that need to be grappled with. We haven't been able to do it in the past. I'm confident that we could do it if we get together, because really, for my observation is that there's two issues on the table, and one is, can we arrive at a definition of mental retardation that everybody's comfortable with? And secondly, can we have a fair process for deciding whether that label applies? And what I talked to Representative Gelzer and the other parties involved, and we're going to try to get together and see if we can come up with a resolution of that problem so that we can hopefully deliver that to you.
Very good. Thank you, Mr. Jundeff. Representative Flores,
and I know we're quick, and that's a little bit of the frustration here, because I would have liked to have heard more of Mr. Berry's presentation to us to kind of enhance the discussion and some of the factual information that he was able to provide for us. So I hope that as we revisit this, we'll be able to have more of that information from him and others.
I think there's more information that needs to be developed on this. This is an important issue, and I think we've only just penetrated to a certain level on it so far. Very good. Thank you, Mr. Jundeff. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3336. Just to remind everyone, we did roll over two work sessions, House Bills 2303 and 2339, to the next day in expectation that we'll have amendments to present at that time. That concludes our agenda today. We are adjourned.